Let's proceed with another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word by opening our Bibles to Genesis chapter 49, which is the prophecies of Jacob, or Israel, pronounced by the power of the Holy Spirit to his boys shortly before his death. In this prophecy, he sometimes says something about the man himself. Other times he talks about the tribe. Sometimes it's the placement of the tribe in the promised land that will happen hundreds of years later. Or sometimes it's some characteristic of that tribe. We saw that the first four boys are referenced because of their inheritance order. Remember, the firstborn, Reuben, was disinherited for sleeping with his father's concubine. So that's mentioned here in the prophecy. The next two boys, Simeon and Levi, they were not in line for receiving that inheritance right because they had murdered men at Shechem. And Jacob even says that they will be scattered throughout Israel, which happened. The Simeonites end up being in scattered towns inside of the region of Judah. And Levi is never given any well-defined territory. They live in Levitical cities scattered through the 12 tribes, taking care of religious matters. And then we have a whole big long section about Judah. And I talked about how Jesus is clearly connected into the Judah prophecy. So the last one we looked at before we closed up was Zebulun. And Zebulun is also a little bit of a puzzlement because this is what it says, Genesis 49:13. Zebulun shall dwell at the shore of the sea. He shall become a haven for ships, and his border shall be at Sidon. Now, when you read the Joshua descriptions of the Zebulun borders, they don't touch on the sea. And so this makes me think there's a possibility that some of what was in the Joshua passage is missing an easement aspect of this tribal region. And what I mean by easement is right to access. And Sidon, we know for a fact, was part of a sea-going nation. Tyre and Sidon together were Phoenicians. And so I personally wonder whether or not Zebulun's territory actually goes up and curves to the sea of the Mediterranean Sea between Tyre and Sidon, a sort of easement between Asher and Naphtali. Next passage, verse 14. Issachar is a strong donkey, crouching between the sheepfolds or possibly between the saddlebags. Some of the wording here, because it's poetic, is a little hard to sort out. I believe it's likely that we're talking about Issachar being such a strong people group, and they are involved in trade, taking their donkeys around and delivering things. Verse 15, he saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant. So that's his place in the promised land. The tribal region of the promised land is nice. It's an excellent spot. It's part of the Jezreel Valley region. And it produces a lot of produce, a lot of grain, a lot of fruit. And so he got a good place to live, so that means he needs to work. So he bowed his shoulder to bear. So he went to work. And then this line, and became a servant at forced labor. Now, I believe that last little phrase may tie into our story from the book of Judges, where the Jezreel Valley, which sometimes comes to us by a slight variation, we call it the Esdraelon Valley, it was the breadbasket of the north. And when they got in trouble during the period of the Judges, the Israelis were often invaded by other people groups that came into the Jezreel Valley and took it over and made the Israelis effectively work for them, do the farming for them. And so I think that might be hinted at here in the last part of verse 15. Now, the next one, next verse, verse 16, is a representation of plays on words that don't come out as clearly in English. So the name of the tribe addressed next is Dan or Dan, which comes from the word to judge. And so it says, Dan shall judge his people. So Dan will do some Danning with his people as one of the tribes of Israel. And we do end up with some judges from the tribe of Dan. Then verse 17 says, Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a viper by the path that bites the horse's heels so that his rider falls backward. And we can appreciate that. We kind of see sometimes represented in film or in storylines where someone's riding along on their horse and the horse gets spooked by a rattlesnake. And the horse bucks back up and the horse or the rider falls off. Well, that's the imagery that's being used here. So what's the point? Is it negative in the sense that Dan is going to be a problem? Dan is going to cause trouble within the tribe of Israel? Because we know there are some stories that go along that line. They are the ones in the book of Judges that are highlighted as starting a whole tribal region at the city of Dan where they are worshiping other gods. Worshiping an idol, an ephod. So is it a negative approach? Or is it more of a positive guardian approach? Whereas the city of Dan, located in the far north, becomes the protective entry point into Israel. And they are biting at those that try to come into the country without being welcomed. And I honestly have to say, I don't know which of those might be the case. Verse number 18, I love it being thrown in right here. I wait for your salvation, O he who is. And those of you that have been long students of mine, you know the next words out of my mouth are going to be this. When you see the word for salvation, Shua, close or connected to the divine name, Yahweh, or just simply Yah, you are seeing the name of Jesus encoded there, because Jesus' name in Hebrew is Yehoshua, which means he who is salvation. And so here we have Jacob inserting into his prophecies about his sons, I'm waiting for Yehoshua. I'm waiting for he who is salvation. I'm waiting for the Lord to save us all. And Moses records that for the benefit of the Israelis and for us. Verse number 19, we have another big play on words that does not come out so easily in English. The name Gad, when we first came across it as the name of the little boy, the baby, it was associated with the idea of good fortune, something beneficial. But in its more literal form, it means good fortune that comes from taking the booty, taking the things left behind by those that lose in battle. And sometimes it's related to the idea of going on a raid against an enemy and taking their goodies, and that's the good fortune. So the word for raiding is related to the word God. And so that's what we see in verse 19. Raiders, Gadites basically, shall raid, they shall do some gadding. They shall raid Gad, or perhaps Gad's the one that's doing it. He shall raid at their heels, meaning he'll get the upper hand no matter which direction the raiding is coming from. Verse number 20. Asher, which means happy, Asher's food shall be rich, and he shall yield royal delicacies. Asher's property, when we see the placement of the tribes of Israel, is on the coast south of Sidon, Tyre and Sidon. And so it's got lots of good growing areas, and it's got fishing areas. And so it's got a lot of goodies coming in. And so that seems to be the prophecy here. Verse 21, Naphtali is a doe let loose that bears beautiful fawns. Naphtali is to the west and northwest of the Sea of Galilee. It's basically the eastern side of Lower and Upper Galilee. So it has some nice valleys. It has some wonderful hills, forested. It is habitat for deer. And that seems to be what is hinted at here, is that Naphtali is well placed in the northern wilderness of Galilee. Starting at verse 22, the patriarch and prophet Jacob, or Israel, turns his attention to his beloved senior son of his beloved late wife, Rachel. Joseph is his name. And we already know, and I stressed it quite a bit, that Jacob has decided that Joseph should get a double portion as an heir. He knows that Israel is the technical heir who will get a double portion, but he wanted Joseph to be on equal footing as his beloved son of his beloved wife. So he took Joseph off of the inheritance list and replaced him with his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. Those two sons were adopted legally by Jacob. And so they will get one share each, which means that their dad, Joseph, is honored with two shares of the inheritance. Kind of a sneaky way of getting around it, but it speaks to us about Jacob's feelings about Rachel and Joseph. So he has the most to say about Joseph. He doesn't mention Manasseh and Ephraim. He focuses on Joseph in this prophecy. So verse 22, and by the way, the Greek Septuagint here has some variations that I want to mention because, again, the poetic style of writing here, the poetic wording, caused the 3rd century BC Jewish translators from Hebrew into Greek to not be exactly like the text we see in our English Bibles, because our English Bibles represent the medieval period Masoretic text. And my preference more often than not is to go with the Septuagint. And so I like to always be aware when there is some sort of deviation between the two. So verse 22 starts with this. Joseph is a fruitful bough. A fruitful bough by a spring. His branches run over the wall. All right. In our English Standard Version that we're using right now, more than likely you have a footnote already that suggests that perhaps it's not a bough, but rather a donkey that's being talked about here, and that there are multiple donkeys involved in the context. Well, there's even more options, because in the Greek Septuagint, this is what it sounds like. Joseph is a son who's been increased. My dearly beloved son is increased. My youngest son turns to me, or has returned to me. And so there's a lot of variation there, and it's all based on the language of Hebrew. Some of the words here have double meanings, or they are homophones, that is, they sound alike but have different meanings, things of that nature. What can we be sure of? Well, the first thing we can be sure of, I think, is that there is an allusion to the son Ephraim here. When it says fruitful or increase, the word is the base word for the name Ephraim. Ephraim's name means fruitful, because Joseph felt that God was making him fruitful in the land of Egypt. The actual wording in the Hebrew text is ben perat, perat. So the son of fruitfulness, or the son of increase. So it's a poetic sort of name. So it is obvious to me, and I think it's obvious to Hebrew readers, that Ephraim is in mind here in the text. And you might remember that Ephraim was the younger of the two sons adopted by Jacob. But when it came time for Jacob to bless them in the adoption ceremony, he swapped his hands around and he put his right hand on Ephraim's head. Joseph tried to correct that, but Jacob said, no, I know what I'm doing. The younger of these two boys will be the more blessed one, the fruitful one, the one that will be more obviously represented by God's blessing. And so it's not surprising to me that his name is kind of encoded in here. So Joseph is going to be very fruitful, lots and lots of kids and grandkids. When you look at the eventual map of the tribal regions, you will see that the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh sprawl over more territory than any other tribes. They need that territory because they are so fruitful. Verse 23, the archers bitterly attacked him, shot at him, harassed him severely. And so the Septuagint has some of the same wording. It's against whom men taking evil counsel reproached him, and the archers pressed hard upon him. And so basically Joseph has some rough times. He has persecution against him. And we know that that happened with his brothers, didn't they? They persecuted him. But later, the Manasseh and Ephraim tribes are in northern Israel, and they do end up being the targets of certain invasion attacks. Verse 24, though, reminds us that yet his bow remained unmoved, his arms were made agile by the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. And so this is the idea that it won't matter what the others do, he'll be okay. The Septuagint says, their bows and their arrows were mightily consumed, and the sinews of their arms were slackened by the hand of the mighty one of Jacob. So it takes it from the opposite direction, that those that attack are not very good at it. The Masoretic text seems to go with the idea the one that is attacked, Joseph, is very strong in his response. At the end, it says, for there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. In the Greek Septuagint, it's only represented as he strengthened Israel from the God of your father. So it's clearly a reference to God doing something for Israel. But we do see language in the Masoretic text about God being the shepherd of Israel, which we know we've seen that terminology before, and about him being the stone of Israel, which we've seen that language before, and we'll see it multiple times, where even Jesus becomes the rock of Israel. He is the rock cut out of the mountain without human hands. He becomes the rock that becomes a kingdom that fills the world, and he also is the foundational stone for all of those that believe in God, who trust God. So Joseph keeps being targeted in this prophetic language as a repository of blessing and security. Verse 25, by the God of your father who will help you, by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that crouches beneath, blessings of the breast and the womb. Now this verse echoes the blessing ceremony we see in other passages, the ceremony that is directed toward the heir. That is the one that is going to become the next patriarch, that he has everything under his hand blessed. And so in this prophetic time, Jacob, Israel, targets that sort of blessing to his beloved son, Joseph, and to his two sons adopted by Jacob, Ephraim and Manasseh. Verse 26, the blessings of your father are mighty beyond the blessings of my parents, up to the bounties of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph and on the brow of him who was set apart from his brothers. And so the language does seem to isolate Joseph, making him different and special and unique, and even separated by his brothers' jealousy because they sell him into Egypt, and so he spends 20-plus years out of the presence of his father not even knowing he was alive. But here in the last moments, the last days of Jacob's life, he says, God's blessing is going to be on you, Joseph, on your descendants, and it's going to be a bigger deal than what has been upon me. And may that come to pass as I've always wished it, effectively. That's what he wanted. He wanted Joseph to be his heir. And then we've only got one son left. It's the baby of the bunch. He's 16 years younger than Joseph. And so here he is with this prophecy being made on his behalf. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. Now that sounds rather ominous. In the morning devouring the prey, and at the evening dividing the spoil. It sounds ominous, but it could have positive overtones on it for this reason. That when you go into battle, you have to beat the other side in order to spoil the other side. And so Benjamin here may be being described as a winner, the one that will win and take the spoils of war, and that he is wolf-like in that. Now, you know who comes from this tribe? The first king of United Israel. That would be Saul. He's from the tribe of Benjamin, and he certainly fits the bill for being that aggressive wolf-like person that wins and takes the spoil. And so there may be some prophetic references to that first king. And then we kind of finish up this prophetic passage with this. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel. I think that's put in there by Moses, who's writing this. This is what their father said to them as he blessed them, blessing each with the blessing suitable to him. And then he gives them his last instructions, which we're running out of time, so we will have to pick up at this moment or this point next time. And that is, with his last conscious breath, he says, "Take me home, boys. Take me back to Hebron. Put my body in the tomb of Machpelah."